Few, but he too had heard of them. The human world. Or at least some of it had penetrated Haven.
"Read it out loud again," he said. And she did, conscious all the time of the sun on the back of her neck, and 72 and his smell and that question, what does it mean? All of it shimmering momentarily and so present and also so insubstantial, like something on fire, hot, and at the same time burning into non-existence. She took her time with the sentences she thought were most important. "He stays clear of dealing with the clinics, even though they've got fetal tissue they'll sell off for just the transportation fee. When I think of people like Jeffrey Ives, all the money in the world and a dead baby that he couldn't save." And finally she understood. "Dead children," Lyra said. "Zombies. Is it so different?" They were making replicas from dead children. Was that how she'd been made? From the tissue of a child who'd been loved, grieved over, and lost? It shouldn't have made a difference, and yet it did. Somehow, it wasn't even the fact that the children had died as much as the fact that at one time they'd been cared for. And yet, the process of making their doubles, the science of it, had turned Lyra and the other replicas into something different. She remembered how sometimes the voices of the protesters had carried over on the wind across the miles of snaggle-toothed marshes. "Monsters," they'd shouted. But for the first time, Lyra felt not shame, but anger. She hadn't asked to be made. She'd been brought into the world a monster and then hated for it, and it wasn't her fault. And there was no meaning behind that. None at all. "It doesn't make sense," 72 said. "Why kill us, then?" "Something changed," Lyra said. She could hardly remember Dr. Haven. She may have seen him once or twice. She could vividly recall his face, but then again she'd seen pictures of him her whole life. Dr. Haven in oils staring down at them from the framed painting at the end of the mess hall. Dr. Haven in black and white, pictured squinting into the sun in front of G-Wing. They stood there again in silence. Had Lyra been intended originally for the human parents of a child who had died? But if so, why had they never come for her? Maybe they had, but found the substitute terrible. Maybe they hadn't been able to stomach looking at her, the flimsy substitute for the girl they'd loved and had to grieve. "She mentions a cure," 72 said quietly. "Maybe you were right. Maybe she did know something that could help us." "Well, she's dead now," Lyra said. Her voice sounded hollow as if she were speaking into a cup. "Lyra." 72 touched her elbow and she pulled away from him. His touch burned, physically burned, although she knew that was impossible. His skin was no hotter than anyone else's. She turned away from him, blinking hard, and for a second, looking out across the park and to the houses in the distance, all those parents, families, moms and dads. She transformed the afternoon sun striking the windows into white flame and imagined burning the whole world down, just like they'd burned down Haven. "On the bus, you asked me why the cuts," 72 said. This surprised her, and she momentarily forgot her anger and turned back to look at him. His skin in the light looked like something edible, coffee and milk. "When I was younger, I didn't understand what I was. If I was." Lyra didn't have to say anything to show she understood. She had wondered the same thing. She had confused it for I, had pinched number 25 to see if she herself would feel it, because she didn't understand where she ended and the herd began. "I started thinking maybe I wasn't real, and then I started worrying that I wasn't, that I was disappearing. I used to..." He swallowed and rubbed his forehead, and Lyra realized with a sudden thrill she knew what he was feeling. He was scared. She'd read him. "It's okay," she said automatically. "I got hold of one of the doctor's scalpels once," he said in a sudden rush. I kept it in my mattress, took out some of the stuffing so that no one would find it. Lyra thought of the hole in Ursa Major's mattress and all the things they'd found stashed inside of it. She thought, too, of how Ursa had just stood there and screamed while her mattress was emptied, one high, shrill note, like the crusting of an alarm. I used to have to check. I felt better when I saw the blood. I knew I was still alive then. He raised his eyes to hers, and in her chest she had a lifting, swooping sensation as if something heavy had come loose. You wanted to know, so I'm telling you. She didn't know what to say, so she said, Thank you. She reached out and moved her finger from his elbow all the way to his wrist, over the ridge of his scars, to show him it was okay, and that she understood. She could feel him watching her. She could feel him, everywhere he was, as if he was distorting the air, making it heavier. She had never felt so much in her life. We'll go back, 72 said, so quietly she nearly missed it. Back? She repeated. He was standing so close she was suddenly afraid and took a step away from him. The girl, Gemma, and Jake. He hesitated. You were right all along. They might be able to help. They know about Haven. Maybe they'll know about a cure, too. She shook her head. You said you didn't trust them.
I don't, he said simply, but I don't trust anyone.
Even me? Lyra asked. Something changed in his eyes. You're different, he said in a softer voice. Why? She was aware of how close they were, and of the stillness of the afternoon, all the trees bound and silent. He almost smiled. He reached up. He pressed a thumb to her lower lip. His skin tasted like salt. Because we're the same. Lyra knew they'd never be able to backtrack. They'd left the house in the middle of the night and they'd hardly been paying attention. They'd been thinking of nothing but escape. And she could remember no special feature of the house to which they'd been taken, nothing to distinguish it from its neighbors. Fortunately, 72 remembered that Jake had written down his address and phone number. They couldn't call. 72 had stolen Jake's phone, and besides, Lyra had never made a call before, and though she had often seen the nurses talking on their cell phones, wasn't sure she knew how to do it. And so they started the process again of asking strangers how to get to 1211 Route 12, Little Waller, Florida. A woman with hair frosted a vague orange color directed them to a car rental agency, but almost as soon as they entered, the man behind the counter began asking for licenses and credit cards and other things neither one of them had. Lyra got flustered again, upsetting a small display of maps with her elbows so the maps went fanning out across the counter. 72 got angry. He accused the man of shouting. "I barely raised my voice," the man said. "You some kind of freak or something?" Quickly, 72 reached for his pocket, and Lyra was worried he was going for his knife. The man must have been worried, too, because he stumbled backward, toppling his chair. But instead, 72 just put the paper with Jake's address onto the desk.
"You have a map,"
he said. His voice was low and tight, as if the words were bound together with wire.
"Show us how to get here, please."
The man reached for a map slowly, keeping his eyes on 72. A TV in the corner reeled off the sound of an audience laughing, but otherwise it was so quiet that Lyra could hear the man's lungs, like something wet, caught in his chest as he took a red pen, pointed out the different bus routes they could take to reach Little Waller less than an hour away. Lyra noticed his hand was shaking ever so slightly, and for the first time the idea of being a freak, of being a monster, made her feel not ashamed, but powerful. There were only two other passengers on the bus, including a man wearing several different layers of clothing who smelled like sweat and urine. Lyra and 72 took a seat at the very back. They sat so close their thighs and knees touched, and Lyra felt the warmth coming through the window like the gentle pressure of a hand. As the bus passed the water park, Lyra pressed her nose to the window, eager again for the sight of all those real human families. But the sun was hard in her eyes, and she could see nothing but blurred, indistinct figures. Then they were on the highway again, passing long stretches of vivid green space where there were no towns or houses, just trees crowning the roads, just growth and dark spaces. 72 was quiet for so long, leaning back with his eyes closed, she thought he'd fallen asleep. But then he turned to face her. The sunlight fell across his skin and made it seem to glow. When he spoke, she felt his breath on her ear and in her hair. "Can I ask you a question about your story?" he said. "About the little prince and the rose?" "Okay." Lyra took a breath. She again had a sense of his whole body extended there in space, the miracle of all those interwoven molecules that kept him together. His eyes were dark, and she could see herself inside of them. "You said the little prince lived on planet B612, he said. "You pointed it out to me." He bit his lip, and she had the strangest desire to bite it too, to feel his lips with her mouth. "But all the stars look the same, so how do you know?" "Not if you look closely," she said. Her body was bright, hot, burning. It was his breath on her shoulder and the feel of him next to her in the afternoon sun. "That's what the little prince found, too, on his travels. He thought his rose was the only rose in the whole universe at first, but then he came down to Earth and found a garden of them." 72 shifted and their knees touched again. The sun made his eyes dazzle and the rest of the world was disappearing. "What happened then?" She tried to remember the rest of the story. It was hard to concentrate with him so close. She kept imagining his skin under his clothing, and beneath his skin his organs and ribs and the blood alive in his veins, kept thinking of this miracle, that he should exist, that they both should, instead of just being empty space. But what came to her was Dr. O'Donnell's voice, and the way she'd leaned forward to read this part of the book, her dirty blonde hair falling out from where it was tucked behind her ears. "He was very sad," Lyra said slowly. "He thought the rose had tricked him. She wasn't special. She was just like thousands of other roses. Identical to them," she added.
"A replica,"
72 said. "Exactly," Lyra said, although it was the first time she'd made the connection and understood, truly understood, why Dr. O'Donnell had given her that particular book. "Just like a replica, only..."
"What?"
"Only the little prince realized his rose was special. She was the only one in the universe because he'd cared for her and talked with her and protected her from caterpillars. She was his rose, and that made her more special than all the other roses in the universe combined." Lyra found the sun was painful and blinked. She was crying. She turned away and brought a hand to her face quickly, hoping 72 wouldn't see. But he caught her hand. And before she could ask what he was doing, before she could even be afraid, her body responded. It knew what to do. It sensed a question and answered for her, so she found herself turning to face him, placing her hand against his face so the warmth of him spread through her fingers. They sat there, looking at each other, on a bus suspended in space. She knew it was impossible, but she thought her heart stopped beating completely. "Lyra," he whispered.
"What?"
she whispered back. His face was cut into geometric shapes by shadows, and he was a beautiful puzzle to her, mysterious and ever-changing. But he didn't answer. He brought his fingers to her face. He touched her cheekbones and her forehead and the bridge of her nose. "Lyra," he said again.
"I like your name. Then I wish I had a name."
Lyra closed her eyes. He kept touching her. He He ran his fingers across her scalp. He traced the long curve of her earlobe, and then moved a finger down her neck, pressing lightly as though to feel her pulse beating up through his hand. And everywhere he touched, she imagined she was healed. She imagined the disease simply vanishing, evaporating like water under the sun. "We can give you a name," she said, still with her eyes closed. "You can take one from the stars, like I did." He was quiet for a while. His hand moved to her shoulder. He walked his fingers along her collarbone. He placed his thumb in the hollow of her throat. "You pick," he said. And for the briefest second, he touched her lips, too. Then he placed his hand flat against her chest, just above her heart. In the darkness behind her eyelids, she saw a universe explode into being, expand into brightness. She pictured names and stars, bright blue or purple or white hot. "Selim," she said. She knew it was right as soon as she said it out loud. "You'll be Selim." "Selim," he repeated. Even without opening her eyes, she could tell he was smiling. Lyra. Chapter 14. Something had changed. Lyra couldn't have said what it was, exactly, only that something had softened in Selim, or in her, or both. They were bound together. They had chosen each other, to be responsible for and to care for each other. By 4 p.m. they had reached Little Waller, although Lyra asked several people to be sure. A policeman spotted them standing at a corner, puzzling over the sign, and came loping down the street. Lyra's chest tightened. He was wearing a uniform similar to the one the guards had worn at Haven, and she thought of that night on the marshes and how the soldiers had been afraid to move Cassiopeia, afraid she might be contagious. "You know how expensive these things are to make?" But the policeman only asked them if they needed help and pointed the way. "Straight and keep walking," he said. "That road runs right out into marshland. Couldn't have picked a nicer day for it." She didn't know whether he was being serious. It was already so hot the pavement shimmered. On their way through town, they passed a blocky cement building called the Woodcrest Retirement Home. Behind a tall hedgerow, several sprinklers were tossing up water, crossing in midair, making shimmering rainbows. Both Lyra and Selim crouched to drink, and Lyra felt a bit like a dog, but not in a bad way. She and Selim were a team, a pack. They could survive like this. They would survive. They'd figure out a way. Together. Selim stood guard while Lyra took off her filthy shirt and her jeans and, crouching, moved into the spray of water to clean herself. They had no towels, so she had to get dressed right away again, but it didn't matter. The water was delicious and cold, and she was happier than she could ever remember being. Then she stood watch for him, although she couldn't resist looking after he'd stripped off his shirt. She had seen anatomical drawings of the muscles connecting the shoulder blades and torqued around the spine, but she had never imagined that they could make this something seamless and graceful, something beautiful. They set out again, their shirts damp with water, their socks squelching a little in their shoes. Neither of them cared. They walked in silence, but it wasn't uncomfortable at all. Lyra and Selim, the two replicas with names plucked straight from the stars. Jake's road was little more than a dirt path through the woods, crowded with tall spruce trees and hanging moss and loud with the chitter of birds. All at once Lyra felt her happiness picked apart by anxiety, by the sense of someone concealed and watching. But the road was empty except for a dead turtle flattened under a car tire, and a bird picking at it. The bird flapped away as soon as they approached. What was that feeling? It was standing naked in front of a team of doctors and nurses. It was the lights in the operation room and the shadow of people moving behind glass. Jake's house, number 1211, looked like it had simply been dropped there, temporarily stifling a nest of exploding growth. Two shutters were broken and the window boxes were empty, but a little lawn had been cleared in front of the porch, and someone had repainted the exterior yellow to conceal the moisture rotting out the baseboards. A cat slunk beneath the porch, and for a paranoid second, Lyra was sure that Sherry Hayes had followed them all this way to yell at them for ruining her pictures. But that didn't make sense. And there must be many cats in the world. There were many everything in this world. Lyra followed Selim to the front door. The sun was hot on the back of her neck and felt weighty. They knocked and rang the doorbell. No one came. Jake's car was in the driveway, though. Lyra recognized it. They rang the doorbell again. Selim leaned in to listen at the door, but it was obvious no one was home. There was not a single creak from inside. "He must be out," Lyra said at last, although she hated to admit it. The disappointment was almost physical. Suddenly she was exhausted again. "We'll wait for him here, then," Selim said. When Lyra looked at him, he shrugged. "He's got to be back sometime, right?" "He said his aunt would come home today," Lyra said. She didn't have a clear sense of what an aunt was, but knew it meant family, like mother and grandmother. "What if his aunt finds us first?" Selim tested the door, but it was locked. "Come on," he said. "There must be another way in." They went around the house to the back. Here there were no signs and no grass either, just a small cement patio and planters filled with dying brown things, plus an old sofa, puddled with rain and specked with mildew. Sliding doors opened onto the patio, and these, Lyra was relieved to find, were unlocked. At least they could wait inside, where she didn't feel so exposed. The kitchen was a mess. There were papers scattered across the table, the drawers hung open, the refrigerator was pulled away from the wall, revealing plastic discs of insect poison behind it. Even the microwave was open. There was mail on the floor, and Lyra saw footprints where someone had walked. "It's wrong," Lyra said immediately.
"What is?"
"All of it." Lyra thought about how Jake had set a napkin on the coffee table before setting down a glass of water, how he had adjusted his computer so that it ran parallel to the table edge. "Someone else was here before us." Selim looked at her.
"Or he doesn't like to pick up after himself?" he said.
"No." Lyra shook her head. She was afraid. "Someone was here." They moved from the kitchen into a small living room. This, too, was a mess. It was as if a library had exploded. Papers, folders, books. A coffee mug overturned, pooling onto the rug. Jake's computer was on the couch, flashing a moving image, a picture of deep space vivid with color. When Lyra touched it, the image dissolved, leaving in its place a small white box and the demand for a password. Inspired, she bent down and sought out the letters on the keyboard, one by one. H-A-V-E-N. But the password was refused, and almost immediately she felt sorry. The help they needed wouldn't be found there on the computer anyway. Selim went out of the living room. Lyra was about to follow him when she saw several photographs displayed on a wall-mounted shelf. One of them, a portrait of Jake from when he was a kid, was framed. The other two were just stacked there and smudgy with fingerprints. In one of them, Jake was standing next to a man she originally confused for a much older replica. They had the same dark eyes and hair, the same well-cut chin and cheekbones. But she quickly realized the man must be his father. In another, a woman with white blonde hair and breasts coming out of a tank top was grimacing at the camera, holding tight to Jake's shoulder as if she was afraid he might run away. Was this aunt? It was family, she was sure of it. The woman also had Jake's square chin. For some reason, this made her sad. Replicas were singular events. They exploded into being and they died, leaving no one. But people were just one in an interlinking series of other people. She made a sudden decision. She would ask Selim to be her family. That way, when she died, she wouldn't be completely alone. In another room, Selim shouted for her. She turned and saw him back into the hall. In the dim light, he looked pale.
"What?"
she said. "What is it?" But she knew already. He didn't look at her.
"Dead,"
he said with a single nod, and Lyra replaced the photographs face down as if they might hear.
"Jake's dead."
He was hanging from the closet door, just pinned there like an old suit. He'd written with black marker on one of the walls, "I'm so lonely, I can't take it anymore." This room, the bedroom, was equally as messy as the others. A second computer was open on the bed. Lyra had seen countless dead bodies, but this one was the first that made her want to look away. Jake Witz was no longer nice to look at. His face was purpled with blood. His tongue was exposed, stiff and dark, like something foreign that had gotten lodged there. His fingernails were broken where he had tried to free the belt, which had been wedged between the door frame and hammered in place to the far side of the door. A thick film of blood and spit had dried on his lips.
"What do you think?"
Selim asked.
"Nurse Emily hung herself, too,"
Lyra said, stepping out into the hallway. A wave of dizziness overtook her, and she reached out to steady herself on a wall. Selim followed her and briefly put a hand on her lower back. She wished herself back into the field last night, and their bodies silhouetted by all that darkness.
"That's what Shiri said."
Selim watched her.
"You don't believe it?"
She didn't know what she believed. "Someone was here," she repeated. She took a step toward the kitchen and stumbled. Selim caught her elbow before she could fall.
"I'm all right," she said, gasping a little. "I just need to sit."
But she felt no better sitting in Jake's kitchen and drinking water from one of his water glasses, which tasted like soap from the dishwasher. Someone had been here. Someone from Haven? They couldn't stay here. What if whoever had killed Jake came back to clean up? They needed to get to Gemma, but she had no idea how. She couldn't keep her thoughts together. They kept scattering like points of light across her vision. An alarm was going off, a beeping. She stood up. Then she saw Jake rooting through the backpack and remembered. The phone. The phone was ringing. The phone!
"I thought you turned it off,"
Selim said.
"It must have come on again,"
Lyra said. "Here, give it to me."
The number on the screen was labeled Aunt Kit, and she waited, holding her breath until the phone stopped ringing, her chest full of sharp pains. People called phones. Phones called people. Would Gemma be stored in Jake's phone? Maybe, but she had no idea how to look for Gemma, how to get to her.
"Lyra." Selim's hand found her wrist. His fingers were cold. But at that moment she heard it too, footsteps outside, the muffled sound of voices. They had barely slipped into the living room before they heard the patio doors slide open and then close again. For a delirious second, Lyra hoped that maybe Gemma had come for them and thought about peeking into the kitchen to check, but when a woman spoke, her voice was unfamiliar.
"These clean-up jobs," she said. "I feel like a goddamn housekeeper. What exactly are we supposed to do?"
"You're looking at it. The first team left a mess. Livingston's worried someone might get suspicious. Doesn't say suicide. You're supposed to get all your shit in order, not trash the fucking place."
"Did they find anything?"
"Don't know. The kid knew too much, though, otherwise he wouldn't be swinging from a rope."
Sweat gathered between Lyra's breasts. She'd been right to worry that the people who killed Jake might come back. Could she and Selim make it to the front door without being seen? They would have to pass in front of the kitchen. If the strangers were busy or had their backs turned, if they were over by the refrigerator without a clear view of the hallway, she and Selim might manage it. The sound of rustling papers, a chair scraping back from the table. How long would it take them to straighten up the kitchen?
Not long.
One of them was whistling. Lyra didn't know that people could be so casual about killing other people as they were about killing replicas. She felt something hard and hot in her throat, as if she'd swallowed an explosive. She'd been angry before, and she'd been lonely and afraid, but she had never hated. Not like this. She hated the people in the next room. She hated Dr. Saperstein. She hated the people who had killed Jake Witz, and the people who'd filled her blood with disease. She wanted to see them die. Selim eased off the wall, nodding to the front door. Lyra nodded back to show she understood, although she didn't really see how she would move. She was liquid fear and anger. She wanted to scream, and she could hardly stay on her feet. Selim moved. For a second that felt like forever, passing the entrance to the kitchen, he was exposed. It seemed to Lyra he was hanging there, hooked to the air the way Jake Witz had been hooked to the door. But then, he was in the hall, and the sound of his footsteps was concealed by all the noise from the kitchen. He turned back to gesture to Lyra. Come. She unstuck herself from the wall. She imagined if she turned around she would see her silhouette, all dark and sweat discolored. On the desk, Jake's computer was still flashing the picture of a beach. And then, for reasons that Lyra didn't totally understand, she was moving not toward the door but away from it. She picked up the computer, which was surprisingly light, and hugged it to her chest. She felt as if her body was making decisions and relaying them to her brain and not the other way around. Selim was white-faced, staring at her. She knew he wanted to scream at her to hurry up. She knew he wanted to yell, "What were you thinking?" She could feel the charge of his fear in the silence. She took a step toward the door. The phone in her pocket, Jake's phone, began to ring. The whole world went silent and still. In Lyra's head, a white burst of panic, a life at an end. The noise from the kitchen had completely stopped. Then, "What the fuck is that?" "It's a phone." "No shit! Where's it coming from?" She had no time to think. Vaguely, she saw Selim disappear, retreating down the hall. She took the phone from her pocket and tossed it on the carpet, then shimmied behind the couch, still holding Selim's computer, as the man crossed heavily into the room. She got down on the floor on her stomach, inhaling the smell of old upholstery and dust. When she breathed, dust stirred on the exhale, but she tried not to breathe. She saw the man tow the cell phone with a boot.
"Aw, look at that. Aunt Kit's calling."
The woman's voice was now distant. She must have gone into the bedroom or maybe the bathroom at the end of the hall.
What'd they think? He was hiding state secrets in his porn collection? They really did a number on this place, huh?
"You think I should snatch the phone?" The man bent down. She saw his fingers long and a little fat. Stupidly, she felt like crying. She didn't know why, exactly. They'd stolen the phone from Jake, but now it felt like a gift, like something they were meant to have. She didn't like seeing the man's fingers on it.
"Hell no. That's the first thing the police are going to look for. They'll know someone was here if it's gone. These kids nowadays."
The man straightened up, leaving the phone, now silent again where it was. She waited until she heard his footsteps go creaking down the hall before sliding out from behind the couch, nauseous now with fear and the nearness of her discovery. Her hand was shaking when she reached for Jake's phone. And when she stood up again, she fought against a wave of blackness that nearly toppled her. She couldn't get sick now. She was almost out, almost safe. She took a step toward the door, and another step. She was dizzy. She reached out a hand to steady herself against the wall. The computer seemed heavier than it had only a minute ago. Her head was full of a strange buzzing like the noise of bees.
"Oh, fuck. Now I left my phone."
She barely registered the man talking again before he had stepped into the hallway and spotted her. He gave a shout, and that, his moment of surprise, of utter shock, was what saved her life. She tore her hand away from the wall and plunged across the living room, losing sight of him as she careened into the front hall. He was shouting, the woman too, and there were footsteps pounding after her, but Lyra didn't look back, didn't stop. Selim was at the front door. He was fumbling with the locks. He was saying something she couldn't hear. The door was open. She banged against the screen door hard with an elbow. There was a view of blue sky, of dirt and grass and exterior, and voices ringing like alarms inside her head, and then they were outside. They were out. Lyra. Chapter 15. They had no time to do anything but duck behind a neighbor's car before they saw a dark blue sedan edge out from Jake's driveway and nose into the street. They waited until the noise of the engine faded, then stood and started down the rutted dirt road, turning onto the next street they came to, this one thick with growth and lined with a ruin of old houses. They needed to get back to town, but Lyra was mixed up. Which way had they come? They turned again and froze. Several blocks away, the sedan was coming toward them at a crawl. They pivoted and began to run. Lyra didn't know whether they'd been spotted and was too afraid to look. There was a roaring in her ears. The car! Getting closer? Down! Lyra's breath was coming in short gasps, like something alive inside her chest. We need to get back to town! She didn't know whether Selim had heard. He made a hard right and took off straight across a front yard overgrown with high weeds. A dog began to bark, but no one came out. They squeezed into the narrow, dark space between the garage and the house just as the sedan came around the corner, and looking back, Lyra saw the woman's face, white with concentration, scanning the streets through the open window. Lyra's legs were shaking so badly Selim had to put his arms around her to keep her on her feet. His chest moved against her back. His breath was in her hair and on her neck, and she wished the world would end so she could end with it, so she didn't have to run anymore, so Selim could stay with her in a dark, close space that felt like being buried. But the world didn't end, of course. When the sedan was once again out of view, Selim released her. "Now," he said. But she found she couldn't move. She was so tired. Wait, I don't think I can. Okay. Selim looked young in the half-dark, with the sky a narrow artery above them. We'll stay here for a bit. No, I don't think I can. Go on. Lyra was still having trouble breathing. It felt as if her lungs were wrapped in medical gauze. She leaned back against the garage, which was made of cinder block and very cool, and closed her eyes. The space was full of spiderwebs and wet leaves. It smelled like decay. What was the point, anyway? How long did she really have? Half of her wanted simply to walk out into the road and wait for their pursuers to find her. Where would they take her? She would be reunited with the rest of the replicas, she was sure. Or maybe she would be killed and her body disposed of. Maybe they were erasing the experiment, slowly eradicating all indications that Haven had ever existed. But it would be easier. So much easier. You can't give up now, Selim said. Lyra, listen to me. He put a hand on her cheek and she opened her eyes. His thumb moved along the ridge of her cheekbone as it had last night. His lips were very close. His eyes were dark and long-lashed, beautiful. You named me. That means I'm yours, doesn't it? I'm yours, and you're mine. I'm scared, Lyra said. And she was. Scared of the running, scared of what would happen to them, but scared, too, of how close he was standing, of how her body changed when he touched her and became fluid-feeling, as if something hard, deep inside of her were softening. She knew that there were electrical currents in the body, and that was what she was reminded of now, of currents flowing between them, of thousands of lights. I'm scared too, he said. He leaned forward and touched his forehead to hers, and still her body called out for something, something more and deeper and closer, but she didn't know what. She wished them out of the bodies that divided them. She thought of the word love, and wondered whether this feeling of never being able to get close enough, was it. She had never been taught, but she thought so. I love you, she said. The words felt strange, foreign to her like a new food, but not unpleasant. I love you, Selim repeated back to her and smiled. She could tell the words were just as surprising to him. He said them again. I love you. Inside her chest, a door opened, and she found she was at last breathing easily, and now had the strength to go on. They made it back into town without seeing the sedan again, but they were standing at the first bus stop they could find, debating where to go next, when Lyra spotted the man from the house in a parking lot across the road. Passing between the businesses, delis, and retail shops that were clustered together, like beads someone had strung along the same necklace. She took Selim's hand and they hurried to the most crowded place they could find, a dim restaurant called the Blue Gator, separated from the road by a scrub of sad little trees. Dozens of men were crowded around a counter, drinking and watching sports, occasionally letting out a cheer or a groan in unison. Lyra and Selim moved toward the back of the restaurant, past old wood tables filled with kids squabbling over plates of French fries and couples drinking and staring dull-eyed at the TVs. A hallway led back toward the kitchen. A girl with a haircut almost like Lyra's was standing beneath a sign that indicated a restroom, her fingers skating over the screen of her phone, her chin prominent in the blue light cast by its glow. Lyra had an idea. She took Jake Witz's phone from her pocket. "Hello?" Lyra held out the phone. The girl's eyes jumped from her screen to Lyra to Selim. "Can you please help?"
"Help with what?" the girl said. She didn't sound mean, but she didn't sound exactly friendly, either.
Selim kept turning around to look at the door to make sure they hadn't been followed, and the girl ignored Lyra to watch him. "We need to find Gemma," Lyra said, "in the phone." She added impatiently, and finally the short-haired girl dragged her eyes from Selim to look at her. "We need to find Gemma in the phone. We don't know how."
The girl snorted. She had a metal ring in her nose. "Are you serious?"
When Lyra didn't answer, she rolled her eyes and took the phone. She made several quick movements with her fingers and then passed the phone back to Lyra.
"You should really keep that thing locked, you know. Do I get a prize now?"
Lyra's heart leapt. She pressed the phone to her ear but heard nothing but silence. She shook her head. "It's not working!"
"Jesus, where do you come from? The 1800s?
The girl snatched the phone back, made another quick adjustment, and then jammed it to Lyra's ear.
"Happy now?"
The phone was ringing. Lyra held her breath. She counted one ring, two rings, three. How long would it ring, she wondered. But then there was a nearly inaudible click. "Jake?" Gemma's voice sounded so close, Lyra nearly jerked the phone away in surprise. "Is that you?" Lyra turned away so the short-haired girl who was still watching her suspiciously wouldn't be able to hear. "It's not Jake," she said. "Jake is dead, and we need your help."
Lyra, Chapter 16. Gemma and a blonde-haired boy named Pete arrived just as a man in an apron was badgering Lyra and Selim to order something or leave. Lyra was afraid to go outside. She thought it likely that the people who'd been in Jake's house were still out there, walking the streets, waiting for them. So when Gemma came through the crowd, her eyes big and worried in that pretty moon face, the face that had so recently belonged to Cassiopeia, she felt a wash of relief so strong she nearly began to cry. They were safe.
"It's all right. They're with us, and we're leaving," Gemma said, and the man in his apron scurried away.
"Are you okay?"
she asked, and Lyra nodded. She felt as if a hand had reached down and picked her up, and again, a memory came to her of warmth and closeness, an impression of one of the birthers rocking her, singing in her ear. But she knew it must be made up. The birthers didn't hold the human models they made. They came and were kept in the darkness of the barracks, and were sent away in darkness too after receiving their pay. The birthers weren't male, either, but in her memory, or her imagination, or her fantasy, she felt the tickle of a beard on her forehead, and clear gray eyes, and a man's hands, scarred across the knuckles, touching her face. Selim always kept close to her now. Even in the car, he sat only inches away from Lyra, with one hand pressed to hers. She understood that they were bound together, and she thought of their lives and their fates like a double-stranded helix, wound around each other, webbed with meaning. And she felt that next to him she could face anything, even a slow death, even the world that kept unfolding into new highways and more people and a greater horizon. In the car, Lyra told Gemma about going to track down Emily Huang and discovering she was dead.
"I could have told you that," Gemma said, and Lyra heard the criticism in her voice, "if you hadn't run."
She was getting better at sorting out tones and moods. She described how they had found the card with Jake's address and determined to go and find him. She told Gemma about the unlocked screen door and finding him in the bedroom with a crust of dried blood on his lips.
"They must have come for him right after we left," Gemma whispered to the boy Pete.
"God, I might throw up."
"It's not your fault," he said, and reached out to place a hand on her thigh.
Lyra saw this and wondered if Gemma and Pete were bound in the same way she was to Selim.
"Both of them, strung up, made to look like suicides," Gemma said, and turned away to cough.
There had been a fire, she had told them. But Lyra would have known anyway. The whole car smelled like smoke.
Must be the military's little specialty.
Less suspicious, maybe, than a gun, Pete said.
She told him about the man and woman who'd shown up only a few minutes later to finish the job of staging a suicide and how she'd nearly been caught and had to hide behind the sofa.
Holy shit, Pete said, and this time it was Gemma who reached over to squeeze his leg.
I took his computer, Lyra said. Gemma turned around in her seat.
You what?
I don't know why. Lyra was still ashamed that they'd stolen Jake's cell phone and left in the middle of the night. She didn't want Gemma to hate her. I thought it might be useful, so I took it.
Gemma blinked.
If Lyra squinted, she could pretend she was looking at Cassiopeia instead. A healthy Cassiopeia. A Cassiopeia with soft brown hair and a quick smile. She could have been number 11.
That's brilliant, Gemma said. You're a genius.
Selim spoke up, too, to explain why they had run, and Gemma seemed to understand. Lyra was intensely relieved. She wondered whether in some strange way, some mystery of biology, she and Gemma got along for the same reason she had always liked Cassiopeia.
And I almost forgot.
She took the backpack wedged at Selim's feet and removed the papers and photos she'd found hidden behind the picture frames at Sherry's house. Before she died, Nurse M gave 3 pieces of art to her next-door neighbor. I found these hidden in the backing. Gemma held the pages in her hands carefully as if they were insect wings. She stared for a long time at the list of names that Lyra hadn't been able to make sense of.
Can I keep these?
She asked.
Okay.
Lyra had been looking forward to rebuilding her collection of reading materials, using these pages as a start to her new library. But she knew they might be important. They must be if Nurse M had wanted them to stay hidden.
I'll give them back, I promise,
Gemma said as if she knew what Lyra was thinking.
Gemma seemed to have that uncanny ability. Lyra wondered whether Gemma was special, or whether she was simply the first person to care what Lyra thought and felt.
Gemma folded the pages carefully and tucked them inside a pocket. Lyra was sorry to see them go.
Look, Gemma said, there's something I need to tell you. Something about your past.
The car jerked. Pete had barely swerved to avoid an object in the road, some kind of animal, Lyra thought, although they were past it too quickly for her to make out what it was.
What?
She said.
What is it?
She was suddenly afraid, but couldn't say why. She thought she could feel Selim's pulse beating through her palm. She thought it began to beat faster.
Gemma was squinting, as if trying to see through a hard light.
You weren't actually made at Haven.
A burst of white behind Lyra's eyes, a sure sign of a bad headache to come.
Side effects. Symptoms. She pictured those hands again, the scar across the knuckles, the tickle of a beard on her forehead. Imagination. Fantasy.
What do you mean?
It was Selim who spoke.
Where was she made?
Nowhere, Gemma said, and Lyra heard the word as if it was coming to her through water, as if she was drowning.
Nowhere. A terrible, lonely word.
This list is of kids who got taken from their families and brought to Haven at a time the Institute couldn't afford to keep making human models. The third name, Brandy Nicole Harless, is your birth name. Your real name. That's the name your parents gave you.
Next to her, Selim twitched.
Lyra's lungs didn't feel like they were working. She could hardly breathe. She couldn't say the word parents. It didn't make sense. She thought of the birthers in the barracks and the new replicas sleeping in their pretty little incubators and postnatal. That was her world. That was where she'd come from.
You have parents, Gemma said gently, as if she was delivering bad news.
And it was bad news. It was unimaginable, horrific. Lyra had wondered sometimes about what it would be like to have Dr. O'Donnell as a mother, what it would be like to have parents generally, but never had she truly thought about being a person, natural born, exploded into being by chance, one of them.
Well, you have a father. He's been looking for you all this time. He's loved you all this time.
That word, love. It shocked her. It hit her like a blade in the chest, and she cried out, feeling the pain of it, the raw unexpectedness, as if an old wound had opened. Although she had dreamed when she was little about going home with one of the nurses, although she'd even secretly imagined Dr. O'Donnell returning for her one day, taking Lyra in a lemon-scented hug, these were fantasies, and even in her fantasies, home looked much like Haven, with white walls and high lights and the soothing sounds of rubber soles on linoleum. She didn't want love. Not from a stranger, not from a father. She was a replica. Selim took his hand from hers. He turned back toward the window. No, she wanted to say. She felt somehow dirty. It isn't true. It can't be. But she was paralyzed, suffocating under the weight of what Gemma had told her. She couldn't move to touch Selim's arm to tell him it was all right. She couldn't ask him to forgive her. He didn't look at her at all after that.
Lyra. Chapter 17. She didn't want a father. She had never even known what a father did, had never completely understood why fathers were necessary. When she tried to imagine one now, she thought instead of God, of his dark beard and narrow eyes, of the way he always seemed to be sneering even when he smiled. She thought of Werner, whose fingers were yellowed and smelled like smoke, or of Nurse Wannabet. A male pinching her skin before inserting the syringes, or fiddling with IV bags, or poking her stomach for signs of distension. And yet, alongside these ideas was her impression, her memory, of that plastic cup, of hands rocking her to sleep, and the tickle of a beard. Selim didn't speak again until they stopped for the night just outside of a place called Savannah. Lyra was both relieved and disappointed to learn they wouldn't be going on. She was dreading meeting her father, whoever he was, but also desperate to get it over with, and had assumed Gemma would take her straight back to him. Now she would have to live instead with her fantasy of him, his face transforming into the face of various Haven doctors and nurses, into the soldiers on the marshes with their helmets and guns, into the hard look of the men who came on unmarked barges to load the body when a replica had died. These were the only men she had ever known. They stopped at an enormous parking lot full of other vehicles, concealed from the highway beneath a heavy line of plane trees and shaded by woods on all sides. Gemma told her that these camps existed across the country for people traveling by camper van and RV, two words Lyra didn't know, although she assumed they referred to the type of cars parked in the lot, which looked as though they'd been inflated to four times normal size. And once again she was struck by just how many people there must be in the world, enough so that even the ones traveling between towns had their own little network of places to stop for the night. It made her sad. She wondered whether she would ever feel she had a place in this world. All she knew was that, if she had a place, it must be with Selim. "I'll be back," Selim said when they got out of the car, the first words he'd spoken in hours. "I'll come with you," Lyra said quickly. But she found that walking next to him, she couldn't find words to say what she wanted to say. It was as if a wall had come down between them. She felt as if he was a stranger again, as if he was the boy she'd met out on the marshes. Even his face looked different. Harder. More angular. At one end of the camp was a whitewashed building with separate bathrooms for men and women, and shower stalls that could be accessed by putting coins in a slot in the lockbox on the doors. Lyra found she did, after all, want a shower. She wished she could wash off the past few hours, the dizzying reality that somewhere out there, where people who birthed her, the memory of Jake Witz's face bloated and terrible,
and the smell of blood and sick that still seemed to hang to her clothes. How did she even know Gemma was telling her the truth? But she trusted Gemma instinctively, no matter what Selim had originally feared. And when Gemma offered her coins to work the door, she accepted. The shower was slick with soap scum and reminded her of the bright tiles of Haven and all the replicas showering in groups, herded under the showers in 3-minute bursts. She missed that. She missed the order, the routine, the nurses telling her where to go and when. But at the same time, the Lyra who was content to float through the days, who lay down on the paper-covered medical beds and let Squeeze Me and Thermoscan do their work, who thought of them as friends, even, felt impossibly foreign. She couldn't remember being that girl. She had no